This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. At one time, Eric Rudolph was one of the most wanted men in the country. He was responsible for a series of bombings in Georgia and Alabama, including the one at the 1996 Summer Olympics in Atlanta. The FBI hunted him for 7 years, most of the search centered in the mountains of North Carolina. The chase came to an end in Murphy, North Carolina. A local cop arrested a man digging in a dumpster. Officers suspected he might not be who he said he was, took him to jail, and there he confessed, "I'm Eric Rudolph, and you got me." Joining us now to talk about the case 10 years later is John Elliston, a reporter who has written about the Rudolph case, and John Rudolph for the Carolina Public Press in Asheville. Welcome, John.
Hi, Frank.
So give us a biographical sketch. Remind us who Eric Rudolph was or is.
Rudolph was a native of Florida who moved with his family to western North Carolina as a teenager and spent about half of his life here. He entered the Army for a brief stint, was kicked out for marijuana use, and worked in western North Carolina for a number of years before he became a radical anti-abortion militant who decided to take his crusade in a violent direction and set off a series of bombs in Atlanta and Birmingham, targeting various facilities, including abortion clinics, a lesbian bar, and, as many folks will remember, the Olympic Park in Atlanta during the Olympics in 96.
And he was raised in a militant right-wing environment, right?
To some degree, yes. His mother took him for a brief time to a compound in Missouri that was run by a Christian Identity sect. They're a somewhat obscure but very militant white nationalist sect, and it's thought that he got some of his ideology there.
All right. So he did some. He was responsible for bombings. Tell us about the how many people died, the casualties that resulted from his efforts.
Two people died immediately, basically immediately from the bombings. One cameraman in Atlanta also suffered a heart attack at the scene. More than 100 were injured by the shrapnel in Atlanta. And very memorably, a nurse at the clinic in Birmingham was terribly injured and disfigured, underwent scores of surgeries to resume something like a normal life.
All right. And, of course, that was 1996, the Olympics in Atlanta. It was a huge story. But at that point, nobody knew who did it and didn't know for quite a while. When did the FBI and authorities finally connect Eric Rudolph to that?
After Eric's last bombing in Birmingham in 1998, two witnesses saw him fleeing the scene, and they jotted down his license plate number. The FBI then traced the number, that license plate, to a residence here in Asheville, North Carolina. It was Eric's mother's residence, and they believe they finally had their key suspect and announced shortly thereafter that Eric Rudolph was on the most wanted list.
And how did Eric Rudolph end up back in the mountains of North Carolina?
He took to the woods right about the time he was announced as a suspect. He was living in the Murphy, North Carolina area in Cherokee County, westernmost county in the state. And he took to the woods and survived, if he's telling the truth about how he spent the ensuing years. He survived for 5 years foraging off the land and pilfering food from dumpsters and gardens and folks' grain stores and what have you.
And the FBI focused a lot of their attention in that region for about 5 years, right?
That's right. They spent $24 million on the search for Eric Rudolph, even after many people believed that he had either perished or fled his home territory. There was a $1 million bounty on his head, and he was almost caught several times, he would later relate. But he did manage to stay on the lam for a full 5 years before that fateful encounter outside a grocery store in the middle of the night.
We'll get to that in just a second, but I want to talk more about the rumors surrounding why and how he may have survived. He says he foraged and was able to do for himself. Others think he might have gotten help. He might have had some support up there.
It's certainly hard to imagine in this day and age that someone could hide even in a remote mountain area for 5 years without being discovered, particularly if you had scores of people looking for you and a bounty on your head at various times. That said, there's never developed any credible evidence or allegation that he was sheltered elsewhere. Perhaps a supporter shared a cabin or a structure with him, but no one's been able to pin that down, and he's insisted that he was on his own the entire time.
And it's interesting to think about the reasons. On the one hand, you might think that someone might have an ideological affinity with him. On the other hand, there was a fair amount of resentment about the FBI tramping about the woods for those 5 years, wasn't there?
Absolutely. That, I think, was the main objection in certain parts of Cherokee County, was that it was a somewhat intrusive search when you've got armed agents traipsing through your fields and your mountains and your helicopters for a lengthy period of time or buzzing your community. I think there was some resentment over that. I think sometimes national reporters would parachute in and surmise or assume that there was a lot of Native local support here for Rudolph. I don't think that was ever really the case. I think far more than anyone would have supported him, they would have simply resented the federal agents traipsing around the area.
Right. I think that's a good point, not to equate resentment for the FBI and, you know, sort of federal efforts to get him with support for Rudolph. So tell us about the capture. How did he get caught?
Well, one thing Eric would do to get by would be to raid the dumpsters of fast food joints. He'd also get his clothing, incidentally, from a Taco Bell dumpster. He would get employee uniforms that had been discarded there. But he had good fortune behind a Save-A-Lot grocery in Murphy, where he would go in the dead of night and find that some fairly good food had been tossed out. So he would visit that dumpster on many an occasion. One night, he would later relate, he was in the dumpster when an officer stopped by in the middle of the night on a security check and took a leak outside the dumpster. But Rudolph was not caught that time. The night he was caught, he was foraging, and a rookie 21-year-old officer, Jeff Postel, pulled up and found this man, thought he might be there to rob the place, so they took him in for some questioning.
And when they did that, he gave a false name when they took him in, right?
That's right. He claimed to have a different name. He said he was a homeless man from Ohio who was just passing through. He'd used that excuse on prior occasions. He'd had another brush with the law a couple years prior where he was picked up on a roadside, and he told the officers who got him then that he was on the road and just needed a ride into town, and he got that ride and wasn't nabbed that time, but this time he was nabbed.
And he was. So how did they finally find out who he was?
He copped to it pretty quickly. Some senior officers who remembered the wanted posters had been looking for him along with the federal authorities for some time. They had a good look at him, and he had a mustache. He looked a little different, but they said, "You're who we think you are, aren't you?" And he said, "Yes, I'm Eric Rudolph. You got me." We have to remember Rudolph had been on the run for 5 years, and if he's to be believed, he was pretty much on his own the entire time. So you might imagine that he was ready to give up. You might imagine that he was just happy to talk to someone. And in fact, the first day or two in custody, he talked a great deal to his jailers.
Right. And you might also imagine that a prison could be better than living in the woods that long. On the other hand, he was actually facing the death penalty potentially, right?
Right. He managed to avoid the death penalty by agreeing to a plea deal with federal prosecutors, under which he pled guilty to all of the bombings, and he agreed to reveal the location of dynamite caches that he had hidden in Cherokee County that he intended to use in later bombings. In fact, he had intended to bomb a clinic here in Asheville while he was on the lam, but the truck he stole became inoperative when he tried to deliver the bomb, when he put the wrong kind of fuel in the truck. So we were spared that.
How much
tragedy here?
Yeah. When they examined those caches, I mean, how much explosives are we talking about?
And I don't have a precise amount, but the FBI published photos, and it was a significant amount of dynamite. It could have done some great harm, certainly in the hands of the wrong person. Ultimately, Eric agreed to serve 4 consecutive life terms, and that's what he's doing now at a supermax prison in Colorado.
He had a lot of camps in the woods, and apparently a huge amount of supplies built up in each of those camps. Tell us about what he had going for him.
Well, he had a rather elaborate operation to get his staples. He would go to a grain supply store and raid the silos at night and kind of meticulously steal away bags and bags of grain that he would make this mush out of for subsistence purposes. He would also, when times were real tough, eat acorns and salamanders and, again, whatever he could forage from dumpsters.
You know, it's hard to think of it now because this was before 9/11, but it was Eric Rudolph and Timothy McVeigh, these kind of homegrown right-wing terrorists who really had the country living in fear. Remind us about that domestic terrorism threat and how much on the imagination was Eric Rudolph in the 5 years the FBI was looking for him?
Well, it was certainly becoming part of our understanding of terrorism, which was a largely domestic phenomenon in the 1990s. And you'll remember this is the era of the Patriot groups and various forms of militia groups that were militant. At the very far extremes, you had your groups like the Aryan Nations and the Christian Identity folks who were hardcore white supremacists who would sometimes stray into terrorism. But sometimes you had folks who were more guided by a kind of religious fervor and fear of a new world order. Rudolph, in his writings, has talked about how in this modern world, the Christian values, in his view, have been abandoned, and the Western culture had been softened to accepting abortion and homosexuality and other things that he believed were societal ills. And so he struck out as a kind of religious extremist, not terribly unlike, it occurs to me, the accused bombers in Boston who are purported to have had both religious and political motives in their act of terrorism.
Eric Rudolph, you said, is now in a supermax prison. Has he repented? Has he apologized for any of what he did?
Not a whit. In his statement at his sentencing and subsequent writings, he has stood by his position that what he did was right. He believed he was a warrior trying to stop mass murder via abortion. And as I said, he was also an anti-gay militant and had some other threads in his ideology. But he stuck to his guns through the years and has remained somewhat angry, militant person.
And he keeps writing, and his writings have gotten out periodically, right?
They have. There's a group called the Army of God, which is a militant anti-abortion group based in Virginia, and they're sort of his official homepage. They'll publish anything he writes from prison. This winter, with the help of his brother, one of his brothers, Rudolph penned a memoir and briefly tried to market it via a self-publishing service. However, once he'd made about $200 in sales, the federal authorities seized those funds, saying, well, you owe restitution to your victims to the tune of $1 million. You're not going to see any profits from this book. And so Rudolph decided to suspend sales of the book, so it's no longer available.
And he is in prison for life?
That's right. The very day he was sentenced, he was taken to the Supermax prison in Florence, Colorado. And he will likely spend the rest of his life there.
Likely. Is he eligible for parole?
Not at all, no. All right. Unless he is transferred to another prison, that will be his final destination.
All right. What do you think up there in Western North Carolina? What are the stories? Is there a legacy? Do people remember Eric Rudolph?
We do remember it. It's some part of our local lore, particularly in the westernmost part of the state. I was here most of the time and remember thinking, well, it's of interest that there's a federal manhunt here, but this guy must have flown the coop. It seemed unlikely that he would still somehow be in our midst. So I think many were surprised when he was nabbed here, and he was brought to Asheville for his arraignment. He was here very briefly, certainly made a lot of headlines after being caught after so long. But he's not someone who comes up in everyday conversation. It was kind of a curious milestone, we thought, to mark the 10-year anniversary of his arrest. But it retained some interest.
What about the reaction? We talked about the coverage of this surge, and periodically you would see reports in the national press of this support that we talked about. They may be supporting him up there. How did the folks in Western North Carolina take to that kind of coverage?
Well, I think most folks would take umbrage at it. There are certainly folks here, as everywhere, who believe that abortion is morally wrong, and there's certainly folks here who aren't in favor of homosexuality, as there are many who are in favor of it. But we never saw any organized support for turning to terrorism. I don't remember anything in the way of apologetics for his crimes.
Do you think this case has anything to teach us about terrorism? Is there a real split between the pre and the post 9/11 era, or is this all part of a larger picture?
Again, it makes me think of the Boston Marathon attacks. It's a reminder that if those suspects are in fact guilty of that, that terrorists sometimes can be loners. They don't have to have a huge support network. They don't have to have a great deal of training or expertise. The bombs used in all these cases are relatively rudimentary, certainly dangerous to be making bombs of any sort, but these weren't criminal masterminds in either case, nor, it would appear, were they operating with massive support. So I think it's a reminder that as much as we're worried about terrorist groups, that the lone individual can sometimes do a great deal of harm.
John, thanks so very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Frank.
John Elliston is a journalist based in Western North Carolina. He wrote about serial bomber Eric Rudolph for the Asheville-based Carolina Public Press. And you can find out more information about the Carolina Public Press at our website, WUNC.org. That's our program for today. Thank you for listening. You can go to that website, stateofthings.org, anytime you want. State of Things directed by Alex Granados, produced by Isaac Davey Aronson, Sean Wen, and Nicole Campbell. Adija Manley and Mark Haywood are our interns. Robin Copley is the technical director. Brent Wolf is our news director. And this is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.